for the last several Sundays, we spent a lot of time in the Garden of Gethsemane. Because as I mentioned to you, before you can understand what took place at the cross, before you can understand what took place at Golgotha or Calvary, you need to understand what took place in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so we learned that Jesus really surrendered his life. He really died there before he was nailed to the cross. He died to himself. He died to selfish ambition. He prayed, "Not my will, but yours be done." And that was really the death sentence of Jesus right there on the spot. We also learned and we watched Peter being broken. Jesus predicted exactly what was going to take place for Peter. It was very important that he be stripped away of all self-consciousness, self-awareness, self-strength, and all of that kind of stuff, you know, self-dependence, so that he would see his desperate need for Jesus Christ. And then, once that took place, Peter will be used mightily as we move forward, you know, into the book of Acts. We'll see how that took place, where, you know, a stripped Peter, if you will, stripped of himself, amazingly, mightily used by the Lord. And we learn that that's true for all of us also. Each of us as Christians, if you're a Christian, then you're a leader. And each of us are going to be, going through that breaking process where the Lord breaks us of our own, you know, self-strength and self-awareness and all those self-words, our pride, literally. He exposes it, then devastates it. And then we can be used in the kingdom of God. So we left Jesus in chapter 22 being examined. He's been arrested. He's being held in the dungeon. I showed you pictures of that last Sunday. And, we saw where the religious leaders tried to make up a bunch of lies to trap him. They couldn't find anything. So they point blank ask him the question, "Are you the Son of God or not?" And Jesus said, "Yes, I am." And so now what they've done is say, "Oh, blasphemy. Oh my goodness, did you just hear what he just said?" So the lies they've tried to make up were not going to put him in, you know, give him the death sentence. So now they're going to use the truth, accusing him of blasphemy because they didn't believe that any human could declare equality with God. And so many lessons we learned. So if you weren't here, you may want to grab the last few tapes. If you've missed any, you know, to make it up just so that you kind of know what's going to take place as we move forward now in chapter 23. So we pick it up. And if you're new, if you're visiting, we study through the Bible book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. Today, or right now, we're in the book of Luke. And when we finish that, we're actually going to skip John because we, you know, one gospel. We'll move to the book of Acts and we'll do probably a few books and then we'll come back to John in a year or so. So chapter 23, beginning of verse 1. "Then the whole multitude of them arose and they led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying, he himself is Christ, a king.' Then Pilate asked him, saying, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And he answered and said to Pilate, 'It is as you say.' So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, 'I find no fault in this man.' But they were more fierce, saying, 'Whoa, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place.'" So what we have, they've pulled Jesus out of the pit where they had him at Caiaphas' house, where he spent a good part of the evening. And now we see where Jesus now, remember in the garden, he denied himself. Jesus will now continue to deny himself as he goes through yet another inspection. Remember, we've watched the lamb being inspected. In less than probably 8 hours, he's going to be sacrificed. So in order for the lamb to be approved to be worthy of sacrifice, they need to inspect him, make sure there's no fault, make sure there's no defect, make sure the lamb is worthy to be sacrificed. So each one of these things that we see is Jesus, the Lamb of God, being inspected. So that when he's sacrificed, we'll find out at the end of today, we'll find that he is a spotless, perfect lamb. So the religious leaders of the Jews, they've been up plotting all night. They realize they can't execute prisoners on their own. They can put them in jail, they can flog them, they can humiliate them and all that, but they can't kill them. That has to be done by the Romans. And so now they're realizing, you know, we've got a problem. We haven't been able to find anything worthy of death for Jesus. Nothing that the Romans would buy into, you see. They're going on the premise of blasphemy because they couldn't make anything else stick. So they have found blasphemy is going to be their reason to publicly put out to the Jews to say, see, that's why we're going to kill this guy. But the Romans aren't going to buy that. They could care less about this Jewish stuff. So they've got to come up with something different to get the Romans to buy into this crucifixion or to the death sentence. But what we see here, and what's fascinating to me, is Jesus continuing to surrender. Here we have, and you have to get this in your mind, the Son of God, with all power, with all authority. Everything is at his fingertips. Everything, he created the universe. In fact, let me read something. You can put this down next to verse 1. Write Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Let me read it to you. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things are consist or are held together. He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have preeminence. So who are we talking about standing in their midst? God in human flesh. With one point of the finger, he could, you know, annihilate this entire group. And yet, what is he doing? He continues to surrender. Here we see them bind him. They, lead him, deliver him. All of these things we're talking about that they are doing to Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God. All powerful. So let me ask you a question. Are they doing something, against his will? Absolutely not. Jesus put his hands out in the Garden of Gethsemane. He allowed them to put him into the pit at Caiaphas' house. He allowed them to pull him out. He allowed them to bind him, however they did, and lead him. He's allowing this to happen. Jesus is in perfect control. But yet they're treating him like a common criminal or an animal. And they deliver him to Pilate. But remember, none of this is happening against his will. This is Jesus Christ saying, this is the plan. I've already surrendered. I've already died in the Garden of Gethsemane. This is now just a continuation and a fulfillment of what began in the garden. So never forget. Never get this idea. Because Hollyweird, paints us this picture of this passive, wimpy, feminine Jesus. And I don't believe that it is true at all. I believe that we have a man's man. I don't believe that, he's not a redneck or anything like that, but he's a man's man. And so don't buy into this idea that, Jesus was this, feminine guy walking around and, with a lisp or anything like that, all right? Jesus was macho. He was a man's man. He's surrendering. He's allowing this to happen. Get that picture in your mind. The Son of God is letting this take place. Now remember, these people are lying. They're plotting his death for no reason other than envy and jealousy. They don't like him. He doesn't fit. He's not conforming to their idea of what a good rabbi should be. He's claiming equality with God. He's done miracles that they have watched them take place. And yet they still don't believe. This was amazing to me. They still don't believe. They're accusing him in front of the Jewish court of breaking the law of Moses while they themselves are plotting to kill him, breaking the law of Moses themselves. In fact, they broke many laws. They couldn't get two witnesses to agree together. Those two witnesses should have been taken out and stoned according to Deuteronomy. But they don't do that. But in front of Pilate now, notice what they accused him of. Did you catch that? In verse 2, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, that he himself is Christ the King. So What are they saying? He's doing, you know, a political thing. He's trying to usurp your authority, Pilate. He's claiming to be a king. He's telling people not to pay their taxes. So do you see how manipulative what they're doing here? They know they can't come and tell Pilate, well, he says that he's the Son of God. Pilate would say, get out of here. But they think that if they can, you know, pull something over on Pilate that would get Pilate angry enough to condemn him to death, then that will take place. But notice something. Pilate doesn't bite in. He doesn't buy into it, not at all. But there's two things that I see that's going on here. Number one is Pilate's reaction. But more importantly, Jesus' response to all of this. Did you notice something? He's not losing his temper. He's not fighting back. He's not looking at him and saying, that's a lie. I never said that. Pilate, I never said that. I've never told anybody, not one time, not to pay their tax. He's not defending himself at all. Did you catch that? He's standing there silently. He's just letting this thing run its course. And that, to me, is radical. Denying himself, even if it hurts. Obeying, even if he doesn't feel like it. What a lesson that is for me, and hopefully for you also. Because there are times, you know, that the Lord asks us to obey, and it hurts. There are times that he asks us to do things, and it gets uncomfortable to our flesh. There are times that when the Lord is leading us, he doesn't say, now, Rob, if you feel like doing this, I'd really appreciate it. There are times that it goes contrary to our feelings. And Jesus, we see him obeying, even though he knows this is going to hurt. This is going to be one of those times where, you know, you're not going to feel like doing this, but true obedience, there's freedom on the other side of that. So there are ropes that are holding him. But what's really binding him at this point? Love. Do you know that the love that Jesus has for you and for me, that is a stronger rope, if you will. That is a stronger bind than any rope that they could have ever held him with. Could he have broken through those ropes? Of course he could have. Could he have, you know, just said, Dad, these ropes are not fun. Take them off of me now. And would they have fallen off of his wrists? Of course they could have. So what's really holding him on? What's really holding him in this particular place? His love for you and his love for me. That's amazing, isn't it? That is the greatest motivating factor that there is in the universe. And so here now Jesus is. He's all alone because all the disciples have run. He's surrounded by his enemies, and yet really he's not alone, is he? Let me read something to you also. In John chapter 16, Jesus said, indeed, the hour is now coming, yes, and has now come, that you will all be scattered. He's speaking to his disciples, each to his own, and you will leave me alone. And look at what Jesus said. And yet I am not alone because the Father is with me. So any time that you or I feel like we're alone, I want to guarantee you something and I want to remind you of something. You're never alone, ever. You might feel like it. Lord, where are you? He would say, you know, I've had him say, hello, Rob, I'm right here with you. I've just removed the sense of my presence because I don't want you to be dependent upon that. I want your faith to be in me, not in what you feel. And I can tell you that is the real growing times that we will face as Christian people. That is when we're really beginning to learn, because that's what Jesus said. I am not alone, even though every physical one has left him. But he said, I'm not alone because the Father is with me. And when you feel alone, remember those words. Remember Jesus standing in this particular instance where he is all alone of those that love him. He's not alone because there's all of his enemies are all around him. But he knows the Father is with him. The Father is going to walk him through this process. And the ropes that are holding him are his love for you and me and the love for the Father. An amazing picture. Well, Jesus knew this secret, that to have fellowship with the Father means you abandon yourself to him and to his will, and you take no thought for yourself. And in all reality, I will tell you, that's when we're truly living. When we get past living for ourselves, and even though I will tell you, you know, I don't know of this side of heaven if we can do that for consistently for too long of a period of time, because I confess to getting selfish every now and then. But I would say that when we are operating in that selfless place, living for the Lord, that's when we're really experiencing life the way it was meant to be lived. And that's what Jesus is doing right here. But here we see another inspection, because the Jews couldn't give Jesus the death penalty. They come to the Roman government, and Jesus stands before Pilate. Pilate needs to inspect him. He needs to look at him. He needs to find out if there's any kind of, you know, fault in him. He needs to find out if he's guilty of any capital crime. And as the Jews are, you know, dealing with Pilate, trying to manipulate him, notice what happens. They say all of this, well, he told the people not to pay their taxes. So here we see what's going on with Pilate now. He says he's a king. And well, Pilate, we know you're the big kahuna around here. And so, you know, they're trying to manipulate Pilate with these words. But did you notice something? Pilate didn't buy into it. He didn't buy into this. He didn't, you know, sit down with the Jews and try to, okay, well, when did he tell the people not to, you know, pay their taxes? Can you have anything in writing? He doesn't do that. He doesn't even ask Jesus that question. Instead, notice what he asked Jesus. Are you the king? Notice he doesn't say of Israel, of the Jews. Is it true what they say? Are you the king of the Jews? And this is fascinating, because then Jesus looks at Pilate, and in a rare moment when Jesus does answer for himself, he says, you got it. And that freaks Pilate out. This blows him away. Jesus doesn't respond to any of the attacks on his character. He just stands there. One thing that Pilate asks him, are you the king of the Jews? Is this true what they say? Jesus responds with the affirmative. And in the other Gospels, in Matthew and Mark, he says to them, don't you hear the things that they're saying about you? Aren't you going to defend yourself? Aren't you going to say something in response to the other accusations that they've made against you? Jesus maintains silence, other than to say, yes, I'm the king of the Jew. And so Pilate, we read the word in Matthew's Gospel, it says, Pilate marveled. He looked at him, whoa, I've never seen anything like this before. Why? Jesus has been bound. He's been beaten up already. Don't forget. He was beaten up by the temple guard. He's been spent the night in a dungeon. So they put the bag over his head. They've already played the game. So he's already all physically messed up. And there's more to come. And so Pilate's looking at him. And he marvels. It literally means to wonder or to admire. He had admiration for Jesus, going, wow, I've never seen nothing like this before. And it blew him away. In fact, it scared him. Because there's something else going on. Pilate knew these men that he was dealing with. If you saw the movie, The Passion, Mel did a great job of, you know, showing how Pilate knew the people that he was dealing with. He knew how the Jews loved to incite trouble and cause things to get stirred up. In fact, Pilate, in Mark's Gospel, in chapter 15, he says, he knew that the chief priests had handed Jesus over because of envy. Pilate knew. They were jealous of him. He was getting bigger crowds than they were. He knew that he was doing miracles, and they couldn't stand it. He was violating their traditions, and they couldn't stand it. Pilate knew what was going on. He wasn't no dummy. You don't run the entire area of Jerusalem dealing with the Jews day in and day out and not know what's going on behind the scenes. And yet, this admiration was not enough. It's one thing Pilate had to admire Jesus, but Pilate should have asked Jesus. He shouldn't have just sat there and went, wow, never seen nothing like this before. You're an amazing man. I admire you. He should have taken one more step and said, how do I become a Christian? How do I take the next step and become one of your followers? Pilate doesn't do that, does he? And here we begin to see something take place. But before we do, let me take you on a quick rabbit trail. Let me say something And many of you, some of you, we've talked about this before. But let me talk about defending your character and your reputation. We live in a small town. And some of you, where you work, you know that it's a small community, your workplace can be. And in small towns, small communities, small workplaces, even if you work in a big corporation where your, you know, sphere of influence is, oftentimes it can be a small group of people. And one of the things that I will share with you as we look at this, as Jesus' reputation is just being attacked, notice how he handles it. He doesn't deal with it at all. He doesn't go after it. He doesn't defend himself. And I think there's a great lesson that all of us can learn in this particular case. When I was asked to take over Calvary Chapel some 12 years, 13 years ago, whatever it is, and my pastor set up a time where I had an opportunity to meet with Pastor Jim and June Hesterly. And so Mari and I, we had this evening to meet with them. And I asked Jim, who had been in the ministry for many years, I asked him, I said, you know, what kind of wisdom can you give me to help me in the ministry as I begin to take over? I mean, if you could give me one big golden nugget, what would it be? And one of the things that he told me, one of the things that he said was, let me take a drink. He said, Rob, never defend your reputation. He said, keep your character right before the Lord. You maintain your relationship with the Lord. And you let him defend your reputation. And you know what? That is something that I have held on to over the years. And I share that with you because in our flesh, and I'm telling you, I talk to people all the time. I talk to other pastors and I share this principle with them all the time. Is that a principle that Jim just pulled out of the air? No, we see it lived by Jesus himself. Because here's what I have learned. I have found that if you want to go out and defend your reputation, if somebody says something about you at work, or if somebody says something about you in this small little community, and trust me, you know, there have been many things in this small little community that have, you know, have been said about me. People have threatened to sue me and, you know, take me to court. And, you know, women, amazingly enough, think I'm a male chauvinist pig. And, you know, of all the things that I've been accused of, that one I don't understand, you know. But maybe because I stick with what the Word says. And the rebellious ones that I tell them, you need to submit to your husband. You chauvinistic pig. And, you know, and I'll say, what? You know, Ephesians 5 lays it out in black and white, you know. And, you know, my reputation has been attacked on many occasions. And so is yours, probably. Whether it's in this community or at the baseball fields or, you know, in your workplace or whatever it is. And I have found that if we get freaked out about that and we panic and we say, well, I've got to defend myself. I've got to make sure that people don't know that, that they know that that's not true. And so I've got to go out and tell them that I'm not a chauvinist. I've got to make sure that, you know, they understand and I've got to get people on my side. And I've got to get my wife to tell them I vacuum at the house. And then I do dishes and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. You know what I've learned? Satan will make sure that that's all you do. That you'll consume your time defending your reputation. He'll distract you, and you'll be running off putting out fires here and putting out fires there and making sure that people think that you're an A1 okay person. And even at times, I mean, Guy will probably remember that, you know, when this one time where a guy was telling me that, you know, because I asked him to leave the church because he kept hitting on married women. Huh. We got a problem here, don't we? And you know, I gave him many opportunities. He refused to stop. So I said, it's time for you to leave. I'll sue you for defamation of character. And And you know what? I mean, we just let it ride. And I'm still here and he's gone. And you know what? I've found that if we follow the example of Jesus, read the book of Nehemiah. And there you see another classic example. Nehemiah is trying to do the work of the Lord. He's trying to build the wall. Sanballat and Tobiah are over there picking on him, trying to get him to be distracted, trying to get him to come and defend his reputation. And Nehemiah continues to just stay at the work. No, I don't have time to go do that, he tells him. Somebody else can go talk to him, but I've got a job to do. And one of the things that I've learned is that if you stick with what your relationship with the Lord, you maintain your character before the Lord, he'll take care of your reputation. It's an amazing thing, and he's much better at it than we are. The other thing that I learned also is we look at Jesus doing this, just doing his Father's will. He has a job to finish. God defends his character. That if somebody attacks your reputation, you know, don't go around defending yourself, number one. Secondly, I have found that those who truly know our heart, listen to what I'm saying, those that you have gotten close to, and they truly know your heart, they'll come alongside of you. I found that when people want to attack you or me, usually they don't have the guts to come and do it to your, you know, in person with you. So they want to tell somebody else that they're sure of, if I tell that person, it'll be sure to get to him or her. You know what I'm saying? Because usually people that want to attack you, they like to do it from, you know, in the bushes and behind the scene. They like to run up and stab you in the back and run away and disappear before you catch them, you know. But what I have found is that if you have invested yourself into the life of people around you, they'll get to know your heart. And when people know your heart, they won't listen to that kind of stuff. They won't listen to it. No, that's not true. I know Rob's not a male chauvinist pig. A male pig? Chauvinist? I don't think so, man, you know. And I have had others come to me personally and say, you know what, Rob, did you know that so-and-so was saying this? Yeah, I know. Well, I shut them down because I know your heart. And to me, God will use us as that vessel, as that vehicle, to be able to put it down also. And I encourage you to do that. Get to know each other. Get to know our hearts. Get to know one another's hearts so that if somebody comes and says something contrary to what they know to be your heart, then, man, you shut them down. Because here we're going to see the Father is going to defend the Son, and that's amazing to me. So now, Pilate now is already showing that he has no backbone. Check it out what he does next in verse 6. When Pilate heard of Galilee, and I tried to emphasize that word, beginning from Galilee to this place, Galilee? When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. Jesus a Galilean? And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. Remember, this the feast of Passover. So it was a big deal down there. Verse 8, now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad. For he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he, Jesus, answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod and his men of war treated him with contempt, mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other. For previously, they had been at enmity, or they'd been, you know, enemies with each other. So notice what Pilate does. We've already seen, we know that, you know, Pilate admires Jesus. He's inspected him. He's found no guilt in him, but he hasn't taken the next step, which is to become a follower of Jesus. And so Pilate has a problem. And this is a problem that I've seen with many people. They admire Jesus. They acknowledge he's a sinless man. They will acknowledge him as, well, he's a great rabbi of the past. He's a great teacher. They will acknowledge Jesus Christ as a historical figure for who he is. But they're unwilling to commit to him. And here we see the reason that Pilate doesn't. And I believe that it's probably the same reason that many people don't. And you know the ones I'm talking about. People say, well, I believe in Jesus. Well, of course I do. No, you acknowledge him. You acknowledge the historical figure. And I think it's important for us to distinguish between those two. Because when the Bible uses the word believe, it means to surrender your claim to your rights to yourself to him. In other words, become a follower of. So when you ask someone, well, do you believe in Jesus? Yes, I believe in Jesus. Okay, do you believe in Jesus to the point that you are willing to become a follower of him, or are you merely acknowledging the historical figure? Distinguish between those two. You need to categorize that. Because once you've got that dealt with, then you can move to the next step. Pilate was acknowledging Jesus. That's it. He wasn't willing to follow him. And the reason being is because Pilate was a people pleaser. At this particular point, he was seeking political correctness. Isn't that an interesting term that we have? It's nothing new. Instead of moral correctness. He wanted to be politically right. He wanted, you know, he was only thinking about himself right now. He wasn't thinking about eternity. He was thinking about this crowd of people. He was thinking about his Roman friends. And that if he became a follower of Jesus, what would that do to all of those things? I can't become a follower of Jesus. And so he was thinking about only the here and the now, which is why many people do not become followers of Jesus Christ. They think this is it. They think this group of friends is it. They think of their reputation. Well, what if I do this? What will the people at work think? What will my desert buddies think? What will my river friends think? What will the people at the ball field think? And so they think that this is it. This world is it. As I've shared with you guys many, many times, this is not it. This is a temporary camping trip. Our life here on earth is a weekend camping trip. We're going home to be with Jesus for eternity. And our lifespan here compared to eternity is a weekend. We don't belong here. This is not our eternal home. So be careful about placing so much emphasis upon all of this and what people think here, because I can tell you, when we get to heaven, for those of us that have committed our lives and are followers of Jesus, when you get to heaven, you won't be able to care less about somebody calling you. Well, they might call me a Jesus freak at work. When you get to heaven, you're not going to, who cares? Loma Shane. Whatever. And so, you know, that really, when you're talking to people, that's what it'll boil down to. Why are you merely acknowledging the historical fact? What is stopping you from following Jesus? Well, you know, it's good for you. And I encourage you, just go on right on the line. You're afraid about what people think, aren't you? That's the problem. You're afraid of what people think. You're afraid that you might lose your job. You're afraid that, you know, people, you might lose your sphere of friends. That, trust me, in all reality, some of the friends that I used to think were my best friends and I would, you know, be with for all of my life, it's amazing that once you become a Christian, you find out they weren't really your friends anyway. They wanted you for different reasons. Christians will hang with you through thick and thin. And that's an amazing thing. And so, you know, we're going to be, you know, as we see in these last days, I think that we are going to be called on to take a stand for moral correctness. In a politically correct age, and it's getting worse and worse, I mean, as you watch this campaign heat up, and it gets so frustrating for me, man, I mean, I start getting hot over this stuff, man. You know, when you hear Whoopi Goldberg say, well, is he a Christian or is he the president? He needs to leave the Christian stuff out of his presidency. Makes me want to go up and deal with that. You understand what I'm saying? Because a Christian, that's who we are. That's exactly who we are. But political correctness would be, yes, I need to separate myself from myself. I need to be one way in front of the public and another way at home. That's what we see Pilate is doing. And I thank God that we have a president that's not doing that. I'm telling you right now. We're going to be bringing more and more things to your attention over the next several weeks, putting truth in front of you. We're even going to give you guys a chance to vote and to register to vote. Because, you know, in our culture, and I know I'm getting off on another rabbit trail, but, you know, if you don't vote, you got no one to blame but yourself for the outcome of what happens. And here we are. We know what is morally right. And you know those that stand for the morals and values that you stand for. And I want to encourage you. Next Sunday, we're going to have voter registration right out in our lobby. And I want to make sure that everybody at Calvary Chapel Ramona goes to the polls and they vote. I want to see your little I voted stickers. Okay? But anyway. But here we see just an amazing contrast to Jesus between Pilate. Now, who was more of a man? In all reality, Pilate, who's in control, Jesus, who's been beaten, is tied up, and is surrendering. Who's the more macho of the two? Who's the real man of the two? I can tell you right now, Jesus is. You better believe it. Jesus is the man. He's living for eternity. He's willing to give his life for you and for me. Well, Pilate says, I got to find a way out of this mess. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I got to get out of this thing. And he hears the word Galilee, and his ear perks up. Galilee? Did you say Galilee? He's from Galilee? Yes. Well, that's Herod's jurisdiction. Herod was up in the area of, he governed the area of Galilee. I'm just the governor of Jerusalem. Send him to Herod. This is not my problem. And he tries to get rid of the problem. And so we find an interesting thing. You know, again, we talked about in the past, and many people have said, oh, see, this can't be a true biblical account because we know that Pilate was a ruthless, brutal man. You combine those together and it becomes ruthless. And I know some of you were listening. I know you caught me. And he was ruthless and he was brutal and he killed people all the time. He had no conscience. And so, you know, here we see this wishy-washy Pilate. So the biblical account can't be true. And people want to say that, but nothing could be further. Well, see, Herod wouldn't have been afraid, or Pilate wouldn't have been afraid to kill Jesus right on the spot. He could have done it. He'd done it before. And I will tell you that that is true. He was a ruthless man, brutal man, and he did kill people left and right. But something's different right here. We're dealing with Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And I believe that Pilate knew that. In fact, in Matthew 27, Pilate's wife has a dream about Jesus. She has this dream. She sends a message. Don't have anything to do with this just man. Leave this guy alone. Wash your hands of this guy. I had a terrible nightmare about him last night. So he's now listening to this. He's hearing this amazing story from his own wife. Now here he is standing in front of him. He finds no fault in him. And I can tell you, Pilate was, I think Pilate was scared. Pilate was scared. It threw him off. He didn't quite know what to do with him, so he sends him to Herod. And then we see Herod's character. And Herod now gets his chance. He'd been wanting to meet Jesus because Jesus had done many things up in the area of the Galilee. More miracles done there than he had done in any other area, even in anywhere else in Israel. So he acknowledges that, hey, I've heard about these things that you've done. I've heard about the miracles. And so obviously eyewitnesses had come to Herod saying, I don't know what's going on, Herod, but this guy's doing bona fide miracles. We've seen them. We've talked to eyewitnesses. I talked to a guy that had leprosy, and here he is. And so Herod knew, but he had never met Jesus personally. He'd never had that opportunity. And so now Herod says, ah, I want to see this guy. I want to see him, you know, do a miracle. Now, is it wrong to want to see a miracle? No, it's not wrong. I love seeing miracles. I'm asking for one for myself right now. I mean, I think it's great. I hope it's not wrong to want to see a miracle. But the difference is, Herod wanted to be entertained. You see? He wanted a dog and pony show. He wanted Jesus to come in and do some hocus pocus thing and, you know, watch this rabbit pop out of my hat, you know. It wasn't to convince him to believe. It was more, I just want to be entertained. I've heard about what, you know, Jesus is doing, so I want to, you know, I want to check this out. It wasn't that he was contemplating of putting his faith in Jesus. It was just because he just wanted to see one. Now, if I were Jesus, and I know we talk about this a lot, and I know you guys are glad that I'm not him. If I were Jesus, I probably would have given him a miracle. I probably would have. If Pilate would have said, or Herod would have said, you know, Jesus, I've heard that you can do miracles. I want to see one. I probably would have done something for Herod. I would have fried one of his guards. Turn Herod into a frog, you know. You want a miracle? Bam. Herod drops. You know, make his mouth where he couldn't speak anymore. Yeah, I would have done something, but, you know, one thing that we see here, Jesus never used his power to serve himself, not once, ever. That was a temptation in the wilderness, not once. Instead, Jesus, what does he do? He gives him nothing, not even a word. That's amazing to me. He stands before the governor of Galilee. He's asking him questions, and Jesus is silent. Again, surrendered. He knows he's not going to convince Herod, and so he says nothing. And how many people do we know just like that also? Well, if I could just see a miracle, I would believe. You guys have heard that before. And yet I have found that, you know, the truth is that there are miracles all around. Herod had heard of all the miracles. He'd heard of many of them. He still didn't believe. He probably met some of the miracles. He still didn't believe. And for those people that come to you and they want to say to us, well, if I could just see a miracle, I would believe. You know what I tell them when they tell me that? Well, take a look around. What miracle do you want to see? There's tons of them all around you. In fact, you're looking at one standing right in front of you. I was blind and now I see. I was dumb and now I can speak. I was lame and now I can walk. What else do you want to see? And really what it is that people want is they want some sort of flashy thing. They want to see, you know, something written in the sky. They, you know, they want to see an arm grow back. They want entertainment. And in all reality, we don't see the Lord doing the entertainment thing, does he? And it breaks my heart when churches get into that whole entertainment thing. Because we don't see Jesus really doing any entertaining. He was a teacher. He did miracles for the sake of healing and restoring lives. And I can point at, you guys want to see a miracle? Just look at the person next to you. Take a good look at them. Look across the room at this group. You guys look over here. I can tell you right now, you guys in the middle, just kind of look wherever you want. Because there are miracles in this room that would boggle your mind. Marriages that were on the rocks, separated, divorced. And husbands and wives have found the ability to forgive each other. That's a miracle. There are people that are in this room that God brought you together from two totally different places. That's a miracle. And some of us have been able to forgive others. That's a miracle. Just the fact that we are saved is a miracle. And so you want to see miracles, there's plenty to go around right in this room. You don't have to look very, very far to see one. And yet, you know, people don't need a new miracle. They need to look at the ones that are right in front of them. And so the Jews, it seems, they're kind of following Jesus to make sure their plan doesn't go right. They keep the heat on. They start saying stuff to Herod. And so, you know, Herod, you know, he doesn't get what he wants. And so he humiliates Jesus, sends him back to Pilate. And then notice something here at the end, and we'll quit right here. These two become friends. Now, I wonder, why did they throw that little bit of commentary in? Why did they say, you know, that they used to be enemies and from that day forward they were buddies? Well, the commentators say many things about that. Many of them say, well, it's because, you know, Pilate showed him, you know, a political, you know, advantage. He recognized him as the leader of the Galilee. And so Pilate sent, you know, him to Herod to have him inspected. Herod then, you know, understood that gesture of goodwill, and so he sent him back to Jesus. And so Jesus became this, you know, goodwill thing that happened between these two men. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But one thing that I've learned in my life, and maybe you've learned it too, is it is amazing at how when people will, when they don't like you, and when they want to come against you, especially the enemy of Jesus Christ, and you are a Christian and you're standing for what is morally right in your workplace, and you're doing the right thing in your family, it is an amazing thing at how two enemies will join together if it means coming against you or me. It is amazing to see how family members that haven't talked to each other for years, boy, when it comes time to making you, putting you in your place, they'll join forces together. The enemy has a way of drawing enemies together to come against the cause of Jesus Christ. And that's something that I've learned. And I wonder if that is the reason that these two became buddies at that particular point. Because neither one of them, both of them marveled at Jesus. Both of them heard him. They saw him visibly. They had opportunities to follow him. Neither one of them took that opportunity. Both of them missed their opportunity, and they're burning in the lake of fire even now. But they became buddies to come against Jesus. And the enemies that are out there, you'll see people that at your workplace that they don't like each other. But boy, when it comes time to say something bad about you or to put a bad word into the boss about you, they'll join forces together. Have you seen that? It's interesting, isn't it? So what are you going to do about it? You trust the Lord. Let the Lord take care of it. He's very good at maintaining your reputation. You just let your character stand before him and let him take care of your reputation. Watch what happens. They'll be gone. You'll still be there. And you'll get their raise. Lord, we thank you for this time in your word. We thank you for this amazing picture of your surrender. We thank you, Lord, that to see how you lived and how the example that you continue to give to us, even in this moment of obedience when it was going to hurt. Obedience when it meant that people were attacking your character and your reputation. And so, Lord, today, I pray that for many of us, if we've been out defending our reputation, if we felt that to be necessary, may we, Lord, desire to live our lives for you. May we live before you with our character and our relationship with you being at the forefront, and let you take care of our reputation, Lord. But I also pray, Jesus, that if there be any in this room that have not yet committed their life to you, that today, Lord, they would not miss this meeting or let this meeting come and go like Pilate and Herod did and not become a follower. And their fear of the people costs them eternity. So today, Lord, may we be people that are willing to sacrifice all of that for the sake of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.